Well, the first thing I want to say is really a little reflection upon the project that the Slough Foundation with the other partners put together. I see a particular value added in the fact that you brought on board people from different walks of life, meaning artists, practitioners of peace, philosophers. I would say myself being a practitioner for, let's say, I don't know, perhaps 20 years, I have been losing contact with a more conceptual thought. I think that this is a very typical situation. People who go into diplomacy typically study international relations or international law and so on. So they definitely get acquainted with ideas, political, philosophical ideas, but later on get wrapped into the everyday action, function-oriented, functional activities that there is usually not that much time for a real deep reflection. So I think this, I really welcome this opportunity to do that, and you know, to also you know, that you created the space for exchange of ideas across the professional boundaries. I think it's very important that we communicate. And here, if I'm not mistaken, Kant actually suggested that politicians and diplomats should listen to philosophers. And I would say that the country where I come from actually was for a while listening to, well, the government of the country was listening to a philosopher, to the great philosopher star of Slovenia, Slavoj Žižek, who was the official ideologue of the Liberal Democratic Party and was therefore advising the Prime Minister of Slovenia, Janez Drnovšek. What exactly, I was his foreign affairs advisor, I actually can't really tell you what a philosopher advised the politician to do, but I can tell you that it turned out pretty well for Slovenia, mainly in terms of gradualism, gradual reform of social structures, of the economic system. You know, we had this socially planned economy where we have now, you know, market economy and so on. And in international relations, it was really all about integration of Slovenia. Upon becoming independent, we wanted immediately to get integrated into the EU. I will speak about that a little bit more later in view of Kant's idea of, you know, the federation of free states. But here, if I may start really with the question that you posed the first time we spoke about your idea of perpetual peace of this project. You asked or you hypothesized that peace is not evoked in daily conversations of diplomats. And I would say that, you know, well, in bilateral, probably bilateral relations, usually not that much, but I would say that in multilateral diplomacy, definitely peace is evoked a lot, usually in the context of conflict resolution, meaning it is intrinsically connected with war, right? It's like a dialectical unity, peace and war. So peacekeeping, peacemaking, peace building, these are all not just concepts. These are actually sets of activities that the UN is performing with more or less success. But of course, when there is less success, we hear more about it. Where there is success, we practically don't hear about it. And one more point I would make regarding the use of the term peace in international relations or in diplomacy, in practice, that is, of international relations. In order to avoid this pejorative, for some people, not for everybody, pejorative implication of eternal peace, of more, spiritual New Agey references. In the UN, for example, you would always read syntagma. Peace is always put into a syntagma with peace and security to make sure we understand we're talking about conflict resolution context or international relations context and not more spiritual things.
You had wanted to frame tonight's discussion in relationship to the potentiality of the small state and the ability of a small state to engage in a multilateral kind of diplomacy. And so maybe you could speak to that.
Yes. Postulate that Immanuel Kant put as the basis of his perpetual peace idea, one of them, is this federation of free states. This, I think, from the perspective of a small state, is extremely important postulate, because on the basis of this premise, this postulate, the democratic peace thesis evolved. So this is a very well-known concept in international relations, obviously, and it basically claims that this was originally Kant's idea that countries with democratic systems, representative democracy, and who are interdependent, are in some kind of economic interdependency and so on, do not enter into war with each other. Now, history proved Kant's idea mostly right. And this is very important because this idea of democratic peace thesis, was, for example, at the very core of foundation of the European Union. The idea was, we have to make sure that what happened for the First and the Second World War will not happen again. Thus, we have to create a federation of, right, quote-unquote, of free states. And so this very idea was in place when, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the processes of integration of the formerly socialist states, countries, began. And here, of course, Slovenia was very much involved. I mean, Slovenia's first foreign policy goal really was to become a member of the EU, apart, obviously, from being recognized and being a member of the United Nations. So, in a way, this democratic peace thesis continues to be relevant. Also in the sense that, it is working. The EU is working. In this sense, it has been working, and it is, of course, we are critical of the EU. It's too bureaucratic. It's too this or that. But, at this larger point, in this grosso modo, it definitely is working. So what is the next application of this idea? Is basically, we have to further extend the European Union, and we have to extend it to the region that is still volatile, that is still a potential source of conflict. This being, the area south of Slovenia. Well, this is Western Balkans or ex-Yugoslav territories. I think that this is another confirmation of the validity of the idea of democratic peace. I would point out the shortcoming of this idea, which is that Kant's idea really was based upon a state as a perceived as unitary actor, not you know, kind of unitary agent, not structured, not right. But so he did not envisage the possibility that a country within itself could be in conflict, could be at war. So, but the contemporary international security system, of course, brought forward these the problems that we had, especially in the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, in the heart of Europe, had to do with internal conflicts, intrastate conflicts. Of course, the theory does not envisage the possibility of internal friction is obviously not of use in this kind of situation. I would point out an example. Macedonian conflict was the latest in the series of the Balkan conflicts of the you know, that followed the dissolution of Yugoslavia. It took place in 2001, and while Macedonia, the Republic of Macedonia, its name being disputed by Greece ever since its inception, the Republic of Macedonia was full-fledged democracy. It had representative parliament. It had, and the parliament even had quotas for ethnic ethnicities, had quotas by which they were assured to have representatives in the parliament. The two ethnic minority parties were in the government, even, right? And yet, a conflict erupted between the ethnic majority, ethnic Macedonian majority, and ethnic Albanian minority. Thus, the existence of democratic institutions did not prevent this from happening. My reading of this is that, well, it really why it didn't prevent the conflict, that was it was actually an armed conflict, is simply because the collective human rights were not ensured. Were not, obviously there was a deficiency in the representative democracy. Yet, I mean, you know, I will not go too much into depths of Macedonian conflict, which I am quite familiar with because I've read my thesis on mediation international, in the conflict of Macedonia of 2001. But I would say that though the existence of democratic institutions did not prevent the conflict to occur, it did help the conflict to be finally resolved peacefully. And whether this is now perpetual peace, that is something, some people are very skeptical about. And perpetual peace, by perpetual peace, I mean the so-called positive peace, right? This is and positive peace means not just the obviously cessation of hostilities or truce, but transformation of conflict in you know, depolarization of society, building of trust, and so on and so forth.
I want to ask you another question with regards to the nation state. And as you know, Kant associates the nation state with morality and with right. The nation state is the vehicle towards peace, towards enacting a more peaceful existence. Today, the nation-state is for many kind of marked by a certain weakness. Its power eviscerated by money and other flows of power and capital. Could you talk about how you see the changes that are taking place today in an age of globalization with regards to the power of the role of the nation-state?
Nation state, I mean, I cannot seriously imagine nation state ever in history as being a particularly moral subject, agent. its importance persists, and I think it is still very important for maintenance or, you know, attempts to entail international peace. I mean, the entire international community is based upon nation states. I mean, when you're in the UN, what I saw in the UN, I didn't see corrosion of a nation state. I saw that nation state is what actually the entire functioning of international arena of the regulative framework is based upon. It is true that you have more and more non-state actors like transnational corporations or you know, the international institutions also develop their own personas, right? As their own power, their own locus standi. And I think very importantly, NGOs, civil society representatives are increasingly gaining strength within these fora, international fora, and that includes the UN. You know, nowadays you have a number of NGOs who have observer status, especially in the field of human rights. I think this is very important. I think what needs to really be focused upon is not, for example, abolition of nation state, but strengthening of civil society, and its role in international relations, and coordination of the regulatory framework in which also international corporations work.
I want to ask you a completely different question. On the way into New York today, I was rereading your op-ed piece for the New York Times from, what was it, 2005 maybe? Can you talk about what was going on at that moment that led to that piece and that article, that op-ed piece? Could you give us a bit of context for how that op-ed piece kind of emerged at that moment and that defense of the United Nations, why it was so urgent at that moment?
Yes, you see, this is partly also an answer to the question that I didn't fully answer earlier. For a small state, I believe that for any state, multilateral mechanisms are beneficial and are necessary for regulation of, obviously, increasingly interdependent world. There are so many areas. It's practically every area of human activity that needs to be regulated more and more internationally. You need to do this somewhere, right? So the UN is has many expert organizations. It has many, perhaps I would say too many, experts and institutions, institutes, and so on and so forth that work in regulating things from, I don't know, mails, communications to human rights, codification of international law in all kinds of fields. You know, while of course it's easy to be critical of the UN, and it is, it's also, you know, frequently it's deservedly. The criticism is deserved. One has to ask oneself: so, what would the world look like without the UN? It's a very simple question, but if you think about it, it's a you get a complete anarchy, or, you know, on a global scale, you simply don't have one organization where people, one forum, where people would come and exchange ideas, where people would come and complain about behavior of their neighbor nation-state, for example, there would be no center where the, as I said, you know, the international law would be codified very slowly, slowly. This is in the UN. There is everything is a process. There are no events there. That's the wisdom. You know, when you come to the UN, they tell you don't expect to move anything forward. I mean, they're but to be happy that you're part of a process, right? So, and that, of course, for a small state, multilateralism is a guarantee of existence, of ability, or is the place where a state that does not have concernable attributes of realpolitik power can actually develop its international gravitas up to a point, international locus standi. And that's why small states are very keen supporters of multilateralism.
On Tuesday, we've organized a workshop at the International Peace Institute. The UNIC, the European Union National Institutes of Culture, working with the Peace Institute, our organization, Syracuse University, and the United Nations University, we've all come together to organize a workshop that enacts Kant's secret article, which in the Perpetual Peace essay explains that as statesmen are armed for war, they should consult philosophers. And what is proposed there is a conversation between the philosopher and the statesman. And so on Tuesday, we're both part of and participating and hosting the embodiment of that secret article. What do you think is going to happen? Does it seem like a peculiar exercise? It's the simplest thing. It's a conversation across the disciplines, but it's also been very complex. It's taken now almost a year to organize. What do you think might happen that day, and does it seem to you as experimental as it seems to me? I mean, in a certain sense, the idea was that the project doesn't succeed or fail on that day, that hopefully the idea of a conversation is something that continues and is picked up, and that the most basic thing, a conversation between the statesman and the philosopher, would be something that would continue on outside of the scope of the project. It wouldn't necessarily be through our framing. I suppose in a certain sense, because it was a collaboration, the institutions that have come together had to kind of begin to speak a language that would be kind of a shared language, and that we each kind of arrived at a table speaking with very different terms and terminologies. And perhaps all of these other components of the project gave it a seriousness that in the beginning it necessarily didn't have. But, I mean, have you been part of these kinds of projects? When we were speaking earlier today on the phone, you had said, you know, maybe I would speak tonight about, and you already did a bit, about the practitioner and the relation of the practitioner to thinking abstractly about peace, not just to the use of the word, but to the very idea of thinking abstractly about a concept.
Yeah, I would say that as a practitioner, but not just myself, I would, with a certain degree of naivete, think that a lot, if not most, diplomats, especially from democratic states, have as a guiding principle, perhaps not very conscious, or, you know, they don't always have on their mind that, yes, what we are pursuing is idea of peace, but that somehow inherently that's what we're doing. I can for sure say with certainty about my own ideas, my own policy proposals, my own speeches, whatever I did in these 20 years in my international relations career was always geared towards supporting in what little way I could the promotion of peace.
With Arrow, with the French ambassador to the Security Council, you know, we asked him how, when we were filming him for the film part of the project, we asked him how our questions had struck him, if he had enjoyed the hour. And this had been the morning after the Gaza flotilla incident, so he hadn't slept the night before. They'd been debating language and its power and symbolic power. And he had said, you know, this is the first time I can recall in some years just being asked to talk abstractly, not to give a position for the media. And so it struck us as so peculiar in that moment when he, and so in a way, interesting to hear him explain that he is not asked in his capacity and his representative capacity as an ambassador to just speak more abstractly or conceptually. And I don't know if that's your experience. It seems your project here as Consul General is quite different, but I don't know, maybe that would be another way of explaining why it seems like it's taken so long to launch this.
As a Consul General, I definitely am never, ever expected to produce any kind of abstract thought. Not at all. Quite on the contrary. Here I'm in position, my function is to further bilateral relations with the seven states of Northeast U.S., in the field of business, culture, science. So, this is a unique opportunity to talk a little bit about the background of actions that are really geared towards, as I said, towards improving or enlarging the area of cooperation, bilateral cooperation. Although I would say that this is not a completely trivial thing. It is a small contribution towards peace, to be sure, right? It's a bit of a stretch to say that, I'm promoting peace. It's a stretch. I am not claiming that. But I'm saying that, multilateral framework is certainly much more densely populated with, intertwined interests, converging interests, and, of course, diverging interests, even more so than converging, the bilateral diplomatic relations are also quite important. There are 193 states, member states of the UN, and each of these states has bilateral relations with more and more states. So there are tens of thousands of these bilateral relations, and of course, if these bilateral relations are cooperative, then of course they are conducive to producing a peaceful international environment.
One last question on my part. I was hoping you could speak to the idea of hospitality that Kant introduces in Perpetual Peace, where he, on the one hand, posits almost as a universal principle or right, the right to hospitality, the right to be treated as a guest in a strange land, in a stranger's home. But he also immediately conditions that and imposes certain limits and borders to hospitality. He aspires to a universal right, but it's conditioned inevitably. Could you share your thoughts with regards to maybe Slovenia or the European Union more generally about hospitality and its limits, questions of borders and how we define and enforce borders today?
Yeah, so this is a very hard question, actually. I would say that Kant was a visionary in the sense that he did envisage the necessity of free movement of people across the globe, basically. He had in mind this, ideally, this global government, whatever, world.
A cosmopolitan.
Yeah. There have to be some restrictions, but in the movement there are borders because, I mean, borders are not just preventing people from peacefully moving and, asserting their rights, their human rights in different parts of the world. There are also things that are not that positive that are moving through borders and part of the reason, I think, why they still exist in such an porous way is exactly that. Of course, the EU, and the Schengen area, the EU is opening up within itself, not necessarily towards the outside world. And And, you know, the consular work is very much connected with the limits of the right to migrate and into a country, stay there, and so on. So this is what visas are about. That's what visas are about. They do allow people to enter a country, but there are certain conditions, that there are certain limitations of, you know, the length of stay and so on.
Thank you, Melita.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.